Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit.
From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more. What would you like the power to do?
Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2023.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Wendy Urquhart, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 21st of May, these are our main stories. The commander of Russia's Wagner mercenary force, Yevgeny Prigozhin, claims his forces are now in control of the fiercely contested town of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine. Cambodia's opposition leader says democracy is under threat after his party is banned from upcoming elections. And
AI feels a little bit like a teenager right now. It's interesting to watch it blossom, but it doesn't really have fully developed conscience or judgment, and you're hoping it's going to turn out okay.
More calls for regulations of artificial intelligence amid warnings that we could lose control of the robots. Also in this podcast, we look back on the life of the celebrated British author Martin Amis, who's died at the age of 73. And it's taken nearly 20 years, but hundreds of antiquities are finally being returned to Greece. We start in Ukraine. Bakhmut has been the focus of the longest and bloodiest battle of the war, but the leader of Russia's private Wagner militia has said the city has now been taken. The leader of the group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, made the claim in a video post on Telegram, appearing in combat fatigues in front of a line of fighters holding Russian flags and Wagner banners. And with explosions detonating in the background, he said the city was now in their hands.
We fought for 427 days when our homeland needed our help. We took the whole city, from house to house, so no one can pedantically reproach us for the fact that some peace was not taken. Until May the 25th, we will completely inspect Bakhmut, create the necessary defence lines and transfer it to the military.
Russia has been trying to take Bakhmut since last year in a grinding war of attrition. Ukraine, though, says its units are still fighting in the city. So what's actually going on? Our correspondent in Kyiv is James Landale.
Mr. Prigozhin is not a reliable correspondent. We should be very cautious before taking what he says as holy writ. Ukraine's Deputy Defence Minister, Hanna Malia, has denied the Wagner claims, but she has said that the fighting is heavy and the situation is critical. And I think the truth is that Wagner Russian forces, they've been fighting for so many months and they have been incrementally taking street by street. And Russian forces do control most of the city now. How much is still disputed? It's still very hard to verify.
So what's the significance of the fight over Bakhmut?
Not a great deal. It is not a strategic hub. The Russians, particularly the Wagner mercenary group, have chosen Bakhmut so they can at least claim they've won something. Ukraine has chosen to stand firm and defend Bakhmut simply for strategic reasons, to try and kill as many Russian and Wagner soldiers as possible. The ratio of those deaths is impossible to know. There are different claims. The most extreme claim I've seen is one Ukrainian voice claiming that, you know, for every one Ukrainian soldier that had died, 10 Russian soldiers were dying. The more reasonable consensus seems to be somewhere around the 1 in 5.
Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is in Japan for the G7 summit. He arrived hours after the US announced it would allow Ukrainian pilots to be trained in American-made F-16 fighter jets. Our correspondent, Laura Bicker, sent this report from Hiroshima.
Mr. Zelensky's taken the calculated risk of travelling more than 5,000 miles from Kyiv in the hope of securing more weapons. The United States has now said it will allow Western allies to supply him with advanced fighter jets, including American-made F-16s. In a meeting with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, Mr. Zelensky said his attendance at an Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia on Friday had also been very beneficial to his country's defence of Russia's invasion.
We spoke a lot about future jet coalition, and I want to thank you and all the partners about this decision, about training mission. It's really, really important.
A singing group marched through Hiroshima, including survivors of the first atomic bomb blast. Mr. Zelensky will hope this somber setting will persuade invited guests, such as the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, of the nuclear threat Russia poses. The two have now met for the first time since Moscow's invasion, which Mr. Modi has so far refused to condemn. The war in Ukraine has overshadowed other issues facing the group of seven leaders, but they've managed to issue a statement warning countries who use trade as a weapon that they will face consequences. They want to send a signal to China over what the United States has described as economic bullying and prevent Beijing from using its status as a manufacturing superpower as leverage over countries when they do something Beijing doesn't like.
That report from Laura Bicker. To Cambodia now, where a senior opposition politician has warned that it could be the end of democracy in the country if his party is banned from taking part in the upcoming elections. Speaking to the BBC, Mardi Seng from the Candlelight Party called for international help to avoid a crisis.
It would be the death, the final nail in the coffin for democracy. Since 1993, the international community had invested over $4 billion in the democracy experiment in Cambodia. And right now it would be the end of it. And it's very sad.
I heard more about what's happening in Cambodia from our Asia Pacific regional editor, Celia Hatton.
The official reason why the party has been banned, Cambodia's Electoral Commission has said that the party's disqualified because it failed to submit its proper registration documents. Now, Mardi Seng and others with the Candlelight Party say that's actually just incredibly unfair because the government, the Electoral Commission, is suddenly asking for their original party registration documents, which were issued back in 1997. However, those documents disappeared a few years ago after the Cambodian police conducted a raid on the party's headquarters. So they say they simply don't have those documents anymore, even though they have copies of the documents. So they say it's just unfair that the government is suddenly asking the party to produce these. They say they think there's some kind of foul play at hand because they assume that the government knows that those documents are actually in police hands at the moment.
We heard a little about what Mardi Seng had to say a few moments ago. What else has he been saying?
Well, Mardi Seng talks of feeling frustration and anger. He said if the Constitutional Court in Cambodia upholds the decision that would disqualify his Candlelight Party, that's the main opposition party in Cambodia, from running in the July election, that really would be the final nail in the coffin for democracy in Cambodia. It's really important to look back on a few years on this. Back in 2018, there was another opposition party, sort of a sister party to the Candlelight Party, which was poised to do very well in national elections back in 2018. The Electoral Commission at the time did a very similar thing. They disqualified that party from running. The ruling party, which has been in power for decades now, then went on to win every single seat in the National Assembly after the opposition was disqualified. So we're essentially seeing history replaying itself at the moment, or definitely there's a risk, a very strong risk, that it will replay.
Celia Hatton there. 20 years ago, the then US President George W. Bush stood under a banner reading Mission Accomplished and declared that major combat operations in Iraq following the US-led invasion had ended. But it was just the beginning of some of the most traumatic years Iraq has ever suffered. Rebecca Kesby asked four Iraqis who were children at the time of the US-led invasion in 2003 what they remember of the war and its aftermath. A few of their names have been changed for security reasons. And a warning, some listeners may find parts of this report distressing.
I can see more or less every single building is in flames. A black plume of smoke hanging over it.
Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force.
At the time, we were living in an area that was surrounded by land and important buildings owned by Saddam Hussein. So in the first few days of the war, that area was like a battlefield. Rockets and bombs from every direction.
This is Bara. She was 13 years old when the war started. The Americans had warned that their opening bombing campaign would be intense. Shock and awe is what they called it. And being on the receiving end was certainly shocking.
I was sitting in the kitchen when I heard the sound of a rocket coming down. When it hit, the blast was so powerful, I was thrown into another part of the house.
Ahmed is from a Kurdish family and was just four.
Once I saw the most enormous explosion. There was a burning car with two men trapped inside.
The heavy bombing in the first wave of the invasion soon gave way to ground troops arriving.
As American forces push towards Baghdad, increasingly they're in contact with Iraqi civilians.
They used to give us chocolate and biscuits. I have still got a matchbox one of the US soldiers gave me.
To our child's eyes, they were very interesting looking people.
Dima is from a Shia community in the southern city of Basra. And initially, many were pleased to see foreign troops challenging the regime.
Some troops near Basra exchanged their helmets for berets.
The most fascinating thing were the female soldiers. I'd never seen anything like it. Some had blonde hair and bright colored eyes holding a gun.
Tonight, the heart of Baghdad falls to the Americans. Jubilant crowds of Iraqis have staged demonstrations, toppling a statue of their president.
We all thought that now the tyrant is gone, we are free. But there was another negative twist in the story, because what happened after the fall of the regime was utter chaos.
10 people have been killed by a suicide car bomb in Iraq.
It's suicide bombers that are the biggest threat to police and civilians alike.
The process known as de-Baathification, or the removal from office of anyone belonging to Saddam's Ba'ath Party, is thought by many to have been one of the biggest single mistakes made by the Americans. Public services, law and order, even the economy failed. The chaos that followed was a breeding ground for sectarian violence, terror groups and crime, which lasted for years.
My brothers and I would see atrocities on the way to school, massacres in the street. I remember seeing bodies with their heads chopped off. One time my father picked up a severed head. It had the word traitor written on it.
Every day we would hear about someone we knew being murdered. It was dark time, and all I remember is being scared all the time.
For those who were children in 2003, growing up in the dangerous aftermath of the war has entirely dominated their short lives.
Who knows what all this trauma has done to our generation? The emotional fatigue. We're all exhausted.
But now, they're the ones who are trying to rebuild the country for the next generation.
Rebecca Kesby there. On Tuesday, a US Congress committee heard calls for the regulation of artificial intelligence, or AI. It's part of a discussion prompted by fears that a rapid rise of AI could end up representing a threat to humans. Governments around the world are under pressure to move quickly after the release of ChatGPT, a bot that can turn out convincingly human-like content in an instant. Republican Senator Josh Hawley said the future influence of the technology is unknown.
We could be looking at one of the most significant technological innovations in human history. And I think my question is, what kind of an innovation is it going to be? Is it going to be like the printing press that diffused knowledge and power and learning widely? Or is it going to be more like the atom bomb Huge technological breakthrough, but the consequences, severe.
Sam Altman, who's head of the company behind ChatGPT, was one of the people at the hearing calling for regulation. And Professor Gary Marcus, founder of the machine learning company Geometric Intelligence, also testified. He told Julian Warraker about his concerns.
There are many things to be worried about. There are things to be excited about, too. AI might eventually help us solve medical puzzles that we've never been able to solve before, cure cancer and things like that. But for now, we have a very unreliable technology. You can't even count on GPT even to understand the rule of chess, even though there are probably millions of games in its input. Sometimes they make things up, so there are risks of defamation. For example, they made up a sexual harassment charge. It was totally false, supplied a source that didn't exist. And then they can be misused as tools to make misinformation at a much larger scale than we've ever seen before. There are also lots of cybercrime risks. So, for example, people can use these machines to spoof other people to give up their credentials or maybe to manipulate them to do other things. And then there's a very long-term risk, which is empowerment. As we give them more power to like directly talk to people, directly harness the internet, write their own code, it just gets harder and harder to make sure that they are secure.
That is all quite a disturbing list. And I sense from you also a notion that everything is moving very quickly and people aren't necessarily able to keep up with the speed of all of this.
Nobody's able to keep up. I think most of us working in the field are exhausted because there are new things every day, both positive and negative. There are new policy developments, there are new tools, there are new risks and ways people use things differently, like this constantly for the last several months. And one of the interesting things about the Senate is that the senators themselves were acutely aware of the fact that what they build are enduring laws and that they don't want to be sitting there saying every time there's a new model, they're going to have to pass a new law and assemble the whole Senate, get presidential approval and so forth. Like the pace of government just doesn't really fit with the pace at which this technology is moving, which is why I was pushing hard in the room to set up some agency that would have power to regulate things and to be able to move in an agile and dynamic way and have the right expertise. And I pushed for that both at a national level in the U.S. and also at an international level. I think we might want some global coordination around how governments in the world handle these things. I think most governments need help. So I think there are a lot of challenges here that ultimately require some coalition of government corporations, but also scientists trying to move at the pace at which this is actually changing.
Is it also like social media when it first arrived, or indeed the arrival of the internet, that it took off at great speed? We didn't necessarily know what we were dealing with, and before we knew where we were, it was getting ahead of us.
That was on everybody's mind in the room. The senators did a lot of hand-wringing, saying, you know, we didn't really get the internet right. And the senators were like, you know, we want to get this one right. How do we do that? How can we be faster? It was definitely not a room full of people saying, I know the answer here. It was a room full of people saying, what do we do? How do we do this one better?
And you still love AI, despite the conversation we've just had.
I mean, with reservations. AI feels a little bit like a teenager right now. It's interesting to watch it blossom, but it doesn't really have fully developed conscience or judgments, and you're hoping it's going to turn out okay. At the end of the day, I do think AI could really help the world in all kinds of ways having to do with science and technology. I think it could wind up being a tremendous net positive, but we really need to be careful to get it to that positive place.
Professor Gary Marcus from Geometric Intelligence. Some sad news now from the world of literature. The British novelist Martin Amis has died. He was 73 and had been suffering from cancer. Son of the writer Kingsley Amis, he made his reputation in the 1980s with a series of darkly funny works about life in London, such as Money and London Fields, and was part of new generation of British writers that included figures such as Ian McEwan, Julian Barnes and Salman Rushdie. Here he is talking to the BBC about why he wrote.
It would be intolerable to me to just be a passive liver of my life. It's only when you write that you compose form and pattern and humour, comedy. Otherwise, the stuff itself would strike me as unendurably thin. It's a fairly constant daily urge. I really want to get in there and will snarl with loathing sometimes when the telephone rings, and really you're very intensely concentrated.
Zachary Leader is a literary critic and friend of Martin Amis, who asked him to write the biography of his father, Kingsley. He spoke to James Menendez.
I think he's a very important writer. I mean, he wrote three terrific novels. I believe. The heart of his fiction is Money in London Fields and The Information. But he also wrote a terrific memoir, Experience. His last book was a memoir as well and has fine bits in it, but Experience is a wonderful book, and it's about himself and his father and his friendship with others, and it's full of characteristic insights and turns of phrase, and it's very funny. But he also wrote a few novels of an experimental character. He wrote a kind of detective novel called Night. The best of these shorter novels, it seems to me, is late ones, Zone of Interest, which is, it has been made into a movie and is coming out at Cannes this year. Terrific, somber novel. He was very interested in the Second War and in Nazism and so forth. He had and wrote interestingly about it.
How did he deal with his father, Kingsley Amis, and his success? He was highly celebrated as a writer. Did he always feel in the shadow of his father?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing about it. Lots of people have said they wish they had a relationship with their father, such as he had with his. You had to be very tolerant if you had Kingsley Amis as your father. The father was tactful about the son, both about his entry into the world of fiction, but also his life more generally. I mean, they were good friends, which is sort of amazing. The anxiety or burden of having a famous father seems to have been mostly an enabler for him.
It's interesting you describe him also as being very funny, because he did have a reputation of being sort of rather misanthropic, didn't he?
Well, yes. I mean, he could be surly. I mean, he was much bothered by his success. They were full of demands made on him. I mean, like his father, his life was a series of invitations, many of which he turned down, and not all of which he turned down with the kind of good grace he would show to his friends. But he wasn't curmudgeonly with the people he liked, and I think he sort of tried his best. He thought it was an obligation to be socially engaged and pleasant.
Zachary Leader speaking to James Menendez about Martin Amis, who's died at the age of 73. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
Phrases like this start off as kind of meaningful novelties, but then they shrivel into meaningless add-ons, really, that just don't have any meaning at all. It's just devoid of value.
Why the simple phrase going forward really annoys some people. South Korean experts are beginning a visit to Japan to assess its plan to discharge contaminated water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the Pacific Ocean. Seoul has so far been strongly critical. Will Leonardo reports.
Japan hopes to begin discharging the water used to cool the damaged reactors at Fukushima this year. It says it's unavoidable with storage space on land running out. The more than 1 million tons of water has been cleaned of most radioactive material, but one isotope cannot be removed. That's led to strong concern from other Pacific countries. South Korea has been among the most vehement opponents, but its president, Yoon Sun-yeol, has spearheaded a recent thaw in relations with Japan, including negotiating this visit of 21 nuclear experts. The team says it will assess the entire process of cleaning and dilution at the plant, which Japan and the International Nuclear Watchdog say will make the water safe. The green light from a now more friendly South Korea may go some way to quietening other critics in the region.
Will Leonardo reporting. A new era has begun in Montenegro in the Balkans. Jakob Milutovic has been sworn in as president, bringing to an end the reign of his predecessor, Milo Djukanovic, who dominated political life in Montenegro for more than 30 years. President Milutovic claimed victory in last month's election, and his party is ahead in the polls for June's parliamentary elections. His aim for Montenegro is to become a member of the European Union. My colleague Oliver Conway spoke to our Balkans correspondent Guy Deloney.
It's out with the old and in with the new. And when I say out with the old, I really do mean out with the man who's dominated the country's political scene since 1991. Because Milo Djukanovic, one way or another, as president or prime minister, has been in charge of Montenegro since that time, and it's all its incarnations as a country, right up to independence in 2006. And even when he didn't hold one of those posts, he was pulling the strings behind the scenes with his dominant DPS party. His party has been on the wane. He lost the presidential election last month by quite a large margin. So this really does seem like a sea change in Montenegro.
That's the old. Tell us about the new leader.
So Yakub Miletovic is not just new, but he's very young. He's 36 years old, and he's been educated all around the world, including in the United States and also in the UK at Oxford. And he has a career background as an economist and in international banking, including at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And he was economy minister in that sort of technocratic government that existed in Montenegro over the past couple of years. And that's why he appeals to people. This is a guy who says, look, I've got the international experience. I am an economist. I know what I'm doing here. Trust me and trust my party, Europe Now. We'll get the reforms in place which will accelerate our movement towards the European Union.
Guy Delaunay. More than 350 antiquities are being returned to Greece after a legal battle lasting nearly two decades. The items, which date from the Neolithic to the Byzantine era, were recovered from a key figure in the illegal antiquities trade. Here's our Europe regional editor, Sasha Schlichter.
This collection includes a 6,000-year-old Neolithic-era statuette carved in white stone, a 5,000-year-old Cycladic figurine, and a fragmented bronze statue of a young Alexander the Great, dating from the 2nd century. All had been in the possession of the now disgraced British art dealer Robin Symes. Greece's culture minister said the battle to repatriate the collection had begun in 2006 when the Greek authorities started investigating Symes's activities. Greece's most famous cause is the return of what are widely known as the Elgin Marbles, taken from the Parthenon and now displayed in the British Museum.
Sasha Schlichter. The British lexicographer, etymologist and TV personality Susie Dent has compiled a list of the most irritating phrases that have seeped into the English language based on a wholly unscientific consultation with her social media followers. And she's got more than a million worldwide. Her number one most annoying phrase is going forward. She's been speaking to Evan Davis.
Phrases like this start off as kind of meaningful novelties, but then they shrivel into meaningless add-ons, really, that just don't have any meaning at all. It's another way of saying from now on, but we don't need another way. That was here first, and it's better. And going forward slightly makes it sound like you're heading to perfection no matter what. It's just, I think, devoid of value.
I don't really mind it. Looking ahead, okay. I mean, these are all about the same length. It's not like one is massively longer or more cumbersome than the other. It's just, I suppose people just want a slightly different phrase than the one that has been embedded in language over the years, and they just want to look slightly fresher, maybe.
Yes, and freshness is all important. Probably put your finger on it, actually, because I think these are now becoming really stale, and maybe that's why people object to them. And also they're being used as fillers without being given very much meaning anymore. And another one on the list was like, used as a filler, which, to be honest, I don't mind so much. Do you know, I did look up the very first record of like as a filler a couple of years ago, and it was actually back in the 18th century. So we've been doing this for a very long time. We've been arguing about disinterested and uninterested for centuries and less and fewer. And, you know, these are not new arguments, really.
But I think language needs filler, doesn't it? It needs the odd...
Yes.
Holding word, because we could edit them out, but the truth is your ability to absorb it would be
so that's so true. I am and are a lot, and I was much reassured by an actual piece of research that was done that played two audio recordings of a conversation, one with all the natural white noise left in and one with all of it stripped out, as you said. And the first one was much more readily absorbed because it does give, as you say, the listener time to take in what the speaker is saying. So they do have functions. I think it's just when they are overused and become so prolific that actually the whole communication is lost because you're focusing just on that one irritation.
The one that really surprised me in your top 10 is the phrase, my bad. That is two syllables that acknowledges your responsibility. It's a kind of, I've made a small mistake here, my bad. And it's not passive-aggressively saying, really, I'm blaming you for this.
I am entirely with you. My hunch is that what people are objecting to here is actually the use of slang, because that's always, always irked people. And the slang is such an important part of the English language that any lexicographer has to pay real attention to it, because it's a sort of sub-language that actually tells us a huge amount about what's going on. And I think that's probably where people are coming from, because like you, I think it's really pithy. More objectionable, I think, is when somebody says something which is quite critical and then at the end says, only joking, which I find far more annoying. So I don't object to my bad either.
Susie Dent speaking to Evan Davis. In February, the Bosnian-American writer Alexander Heyman brought out his latest novel, The World and All That It Holds. It's an epic tale of love that takes readers on a journey from World War I in the Bosnian capital Sarajevo to many other countries throughout the decades. He worked closely with the Bosnian musician Damir Imamović to accurately portray the music of that time. Now, Damir Imamović has released an album which is also called The World and All That It Holds to accompany the book. He's been speaking to Martin Venard.
The story of The World and All That It Holds concerns two Bosnian characters. One of them is a Bosnian Muslim from Sarajevo and another one is a Sephardic Jew. They actually communicate through songs a lot. There are many common melodies between Jewish and Muslim tradition in Bosnia. And Alexander wanted to use this connection to connect these two characters. But the novelty for this particular album was Sephardic tradition, Ladino songs. Madre mia, si me muero. It's basically a language of Sephardic Jews who escaped 15th century Spain and came to Ottoman Empire. There was a huge community of them living in Sarajevo, Bosnia. Some of them still sing these songs, you know, in 15th century Spanish. Sarajevo always used to be quite a multicultural place. We ended up having old Bosnian Muslim tunes sung in Slavic language. Sevda music is a musical genre indigenous to Bosnia and Herzegovina. And it's a combination of an old South Slavic poetry, you know, balladry and epic songs and lyrical songs, and musical influences that spread from the old times of Ottoman Empire. The very word Sevda means actually love. Sarajevo is, I think, very important for both me and Alexander Heyman. He was born here, he grew up here, I was also born here, I grew up here, I still live in Sarajevo. And Sarajevo is actually a place where the First World War started. It was important also in Second World War. Unfortunately, people know Sarajevo mostly for those bad political developments like beginning of World Wars or the siege of Sarajevo in the 90s. We want it to be a symbol of people living together and having a common culture.
Is there an optimistic future for Sarajevo?
I just hope that in the future we'll have peace and that Sarajevo will be famous for many other beautiful things such as film, theater, music, and not for conflict and war.
Damir Imamović talking to Martin Venard. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Wayne Moses and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin and I'm Wendy Urquhart. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit.
If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do?
Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2023.